Hello and welcome to In Focus with Insight. My name is Pamela Hillig. I'm head of Insight Life Solutions. And today we have an episode of the Open Books series where we get to know fascinating and inspiring people in the actuarial community through the books they have read and loved. Today I'm joined by Louis Rousseau. As segment head of research and analytics, Louis is based in Genry's Cape Town office. He and his team look after life insurance clients in Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and of course, South Africa with all their research and analytics needs. He previously worked on individual pricing and product development, group pricing and reserving. He's also worked in Genry's Singapore branch as regional chief actuary. He currently serves on the Actuarial Society of South Africa's Continuous Statistical Investigations Committee, as well as on ASSA Council. And he was a member of the IFRA's COVID-19 Actuaries Response Group. Many of us will know Louis from conventions and seminars where he always presents his fascinating research. So welcome, Louis.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So tell me, are you a reader?
I'm a reader, but I have to watch myself because sometimes, so I read rarely, but when I read very intensively, so I can't put books down. So I would be... going reading late at night and until the book is finished, really, I'd be completely committed. So that drives other people mad if I do that. And obviously, I don't have as much time to do that sort of thing.
Okay, so you channel your addictive energy into reading. Well, I'm glad to hear that because this isn't like your normal podcast interview. So we will be talking about your career and the things that are keeping you busy, but with an added angle of books that have made an impact on you. So you can think of it as the desert island discs for bibliophiles.
Okay.
But let's get started with a bit about you. Tell me, what's keeping you busy these days?
Well, at the moment, I just joined council. So a lot of council activity at the moment around, you know, the actual society, getting to understand how council works and how those things operate. So that's been quite busy. In terms of work, a lot of things around understanding AI and its impact, so thinking around that. A lot of work, you know, for the last number of years, focusing a lot on how analytics and the world of actuarial science overlaps and how we can best sort of adapt and use sort of these new analytics techniques, be that simple GLMs to, well, not that new, that's GLMs, but also things like neural networks and these large language models. How can we use them in our actual work, but also then in the insurance industry?
Okay, amazing. And I can't wait to hear how your reading has influenced some of your thinking around these topics.
Yeah.
And before we get into the books, I'd like to find out a bit about your reading habits. So have you always loved reading, or when did your love of reading start?
Yeah, no, I read from a young age. In primary school, I read quite a bit. Started with, I think, Fritz Thielmann was some spy-like character in Afrikaans. Read a lot of his books, and there was some sci-fi book as well. I can't remember the name of it, but I think it was Afrikaans as well. And then from there on, I just kept reading.
So what genres do you tend to read these days?
These days, I don't read as much as I want to, but I read fiction, basically. I really struggle to read nonfiction. That's not something I can always get into, and unless it's really good, one or two nonfiction books will get me, but mainly fiction. Tend to focus on sci-fi, fantasy type stuff, and books, really, I enjoy books that have like a world around them, really a whole sort of, you know, Discworld, for example, that I sort of mentioned to you earlier. As well as, you know, books like that where there's a whole universe around them, a whole series of books potentially.
What do you think it is about this world building or universe building fantasy series that appeals to you so much?
Maybe just the creature of habit, in the sense that I, once I get stuck into something I like, I just want to read more of it. Maybe that's just it. Maybe it's a bit of a creature of habit. I enjoy the long threads, and some of these books have very nice, interesting long threads running through them. And then if you, some of these authors also tend to go into a lot of detail into sort of constructing their whole universe. I mean, Tolkien being one example of that, in terms of building languages and poetry and songs and all the characters and, you know, the whole universe of interesting things that are happening there. Although there, some of them are really a bit, let me say, over the top in terms of what they do.
Yeah, it's crazy to think how these universes can spring from one person's mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. And can you describe your perfect reading setting?
I can't really read anywhere. I don't really have. I can't have the ability to just zone out and read if I need to. But pretty much, on the couch or lying in bed late at night, reading into the early hours. That's when it gets really quiet. I really enjoy it too.
Were you someone who studied late at night as well?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess you can separate people into, you know, early birds and not. Because when I read at night, it makes me fall asleep.
Oh, no.
You have the opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If it's a good book, I can't stop reading. That causes me problems in the next morning. Yeah.
You've approached the challenge slightly differently today in that you've named a few series of books rather than individual books. So let's get into the first series you're going to talk about, which was the Isaac Asimov series.
Yeah.
So can you tell us, we don't have it with us today, but can you tell us how you came across the series, what it's about, what you love about it?
I can't remember how I came across it. I was probably in the Stellenbosch pub and I was browsing the sci-fi section, or I'm not sure exactly how I came across it. I started reading it and there was a whole shelf of these books and they were all by Asimov. He wrote stories. I mean, he's most famous for developing the three laws of robotics, right? So you can hear that when people talk about the philosophy of AI and things like that these days, they might be actually referencing some of Asimov's laws in terms of safety and, you know, how do we protect ourselves from these things. He kind of developed a set of laws around that. So I started reading some of his robot books and the robot short stories. He had a whole series of short stories. And then I went to the Foundation series, which kind of builds upon that world in a way and develops an empire that effectually has, there was some robot wars as well. And this empire has now banished all robots from existence. And then there's a whole story about how that empire falls. And there's even an actuary-like character in there, which I thought was very interesting, which I was reading while I was in high school and studying to be an actuary at Stellenbosch. So I'm not sure to what degree that played into my mind, but yeah, that's quite interesting.
And how do you think, his views of robotics and AI and whatever, machine learning and actuaries, how has that influenced your thinking in this area?
I don't know. I haven't really, so I wouldn't say I had a strong influence from there, but I think if you think about the kind of things that while sort of thinking about this podcast and today's interview, thinking about how to relate that, some of that, I think the first thing is the robots had a code, essentially, a code of, if you will, code of conduct. Of course, their code was essentially hardwired. The first books really talked to those, the first books in that sort of longer series really talked about to that sort of laws of robotics. I don't know if you remember Will Smith played in the movie I, Robot. That is based off one of Asimov's, or a collection of his stories actually rolled up into one movie. So that talks to these robots that are accused of crimes by humans. And invariably in those short stories and those longer stories, it turns out that the humans did something wrong and tried to hide it using a robot. And of course, the code of these robots was so hardwired into them that they couldn't actually commit the crimes they were accused of. And that's kind of the essence to many of his stories, either through some misunderstanding or through some willfulness by some person, that code was essentially broken, but it wasn't really broken because often the robots actually saw a bigger picture, actually, by not harming a human or doing something that could be perceived to be harmful, that actually saw a bigger picture and prevented a greater harm down the track, for example. The cleverer robots could do that, right? So that, what I think is interesting in terms of thinking about our code of conduct, which of course is not hardwired in our brains and we often struggle to stick with it. I think that's something that's relevant to us. I think the other area that's interesting, and I'm not sure it's super relevant.
IBNR. Interesting, but not relevant.
Yeah. Is Harry Seldon, the character in the Foundation's core series. There's also now a TV series out on that, on Apple TV, covering the Foundation series. And this Harry Seldon character is actually a psychohistorian, he described himself, but it's actually around using statistics and other methods, sort of advanced statistics, of course, that's like obviously part of the science fiction, but really trying to predict the behavior of the galaxy or all the people in the galaxy at that point in time, and to get long-term trends and to really analyze the long-term future of the galaxy. And then what he actually tries is to tries to improve on that, right? He tries to avoid essentially what is classed as middle age. His statistics predicts a sort of a middle ages for this galaxy that he's living in, and he tries to shorten that by influencing behaviors and essentially the politics of the time such that sort of period of darkness is shortened as much as possible.
So you were talking about the codes of conduct earlier, and yeah. I think I think you brought one of those, or we brought that as a quote along that you'd like to read for us from the book.
Which quote? The law?
Yeah. I'm interested in what these other laws are that the robots need to adhere to.
So, the three laws of robotics, according to Isaac Asimov. The first law, a robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. The second law, a robot must obey the orders given to it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. And then lastly, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first and second law. So really, that's just it's just a very simple code of conduct, really, really principles-based, but basically saying this is the protections that society designed to protect us from advanced intelligence that potentially are more powerful than humans and more clever than humans. They kind of hardwired the brains of these robots to obey these laws. And you'll see early talks about robotics and even, you know, serious discussions around robotics that were more in the science realm early on in, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s. People often quoted Asimov's laws as a principle that we should try and use and think about when we just design advanced robotics.
So what's your work in AI and that kind of thing?
So, I mean, currently if you think about AI, I think it's a little bit of an overused word, to be honest. I tend to steer away from it because artificial intelligence is not clearly enough defined, really, to know what it exactly is. I think larger language models is the new trend, and these large language models have interesting use cases, I think, and trying to figure out what those might be. Now, there are numerous use cases where you can think about them at the moment, and some of them would be, for example, to understand lots of documents, right? So if you're thinking about the insurance context, we receive lots of reports when we underwrite cases, when we underwrite people, receive reams and reams of medical reports, financial reports. How can we make sense of those quickly and efficiently? I think large language models has a role to play there to help our underwriters sort of make sense of lots of text and information like that. I also think that's an interesting field too. In terms of supporting more what the kind of stuff that I'm directly doing, I think large language model has the ability to translate text into numerics, such that we can use that as inputs into a more statistical and analytical models. I think that's also there. And largely the place that I'm not really involved in, I'm not a big communicator or a engager, but I think insurance companies talk to many people a lot. Our brokers, our agents, our telephone people, the call center staff, they all talk to people all the time. How can we make sure that we can personalize that communication in an effective way? And particularly if you look at lower ends of the markets where they don't get communication, how can we personalize that to communication, both the receiving of information as well as the engaging of customers? I think large language models there, to me, has an obvious role to play as a way to personalize communications. I've played around, for example, with some of these and said, you know, can you give me financial advice? I have one of my presentations that I do is where I show, I ask one of these ChatGPT, I think it was. I ask, can you give me financial advice? I'm married, I have kids. You know, what insurance should I buy? And it gave me pretty decent financial advice. And then I said, can you change it if I'm not married, or can you? And then it came up with more customized financial advice. So that is like a low end financial advice solution there. I also asked it to explain some things in a different language or a different context. So explain it to an older person that has limited understanding, explain it to a younger person, explain it to somebody who's financially educated. How do you explain some of these insurance concepts to them? And I think that's a way to customize our communication quite effectively.
So do you think the potential for AI, whatever we may take it to mean, for insurers at the moment lies mostly in the front office, dealing with stakeholders as opposed to back office processes?
I think back office processes where there's lots of text, and I think front office opportunities are great, particularly at the lower end of the market where there's no advice or communication that is specialized or customized to the individual. So imagine there's limited financial advice potentially on a funeral policy. Can we improve that financial advice on a funeral policy using tools like this that advise people about, what kind of funeral policy they need to do or how they need to manage that? Can we use some of these techniques to reach markets where the cost of advice is prohibitive at this point in time, and particularly customizing that advice? A new technology, the classic, disruption model. I can't remember now who the authors are, but they really talk about low-end disruption first. Low-end disruption starts with low-end disruption, where new technology allows you to reach customers that are previously unreached at all. Yeah. And then as that becomes better and better, it might actually move into the higher end or higher income markets.
Okay. So you think we're still far away from the one-click valuation?
Yes. Because they keep changing the regulation, right? So
yeah. So how do you build in the rules? Can you read us another one of your favorite quotes from this author?
The character I was mentioning that sort of doing stats and sort of almost actuarial science in a science fiction kind of way, he Harry Seldon, he says, "Never let your sense of morals prevent you from doing what is right." I really think it's about sort of this idea of moral outrage or anything like that. It's really, you need to do what is right. That's the, to me, what was important. So he is a bit of a strange character because he kind of follows some of that logic throughout the book, which really irritates a lot of people around him, where he's thinking of this big picture and he kind of messes up a lot of things around him as he goes along. So that's I'm not sure he's the most likable character for that.
Well, it's always good to find actuarial type characters in fiction. They're so few and far between.
Yeah.
Perhaps just a question on that. How do you know what is right?
Sure. That's deep. I'll refer you to Sophie's World, which we're going to get to later.
We'll wait for that. Okay. So let's move on to the next series we're going to talk about, which I think is probably, everyone would have heard of, is the Middle Earth, I guess, series or universe by J.R.R. Tolkien. And I think is that the full Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, this is the trilogy in one.
Trilogy that you've brought along today. Yeah, so tell me.
It's my well-eared copy.
Yeah, when did you come across this series?
This is also, Tolkien, I also read from the Stellenbosch Bob a lot.
Okay.
They had most of his, obviously The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings trilogy, but they also had a bunch of other works. And I can't remember exactly what they had, because some of it I read after, but they had, for example, his main books were The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. But after his death, they discovered a bunch of papers in his drawers and his study, which really talked about all his whole universe. So a lot of the books refer to stories that happened before them. So for example, how Elrond got where he got to. I can't remember exactly all these stories, but for example, we talk about Rivendell and where they reach Elrond, the sort of head elf or the king of the elves in Rivendell. How did he get there? What's the backstory to that? This book goes into, there's lots of short stories and books around how people got to where they got to. If you remember the spider in the cave that Frodo and Samwise sort of confront and kill, there's a whole story about how that spider got where it got to there. And there's a whole, you can go read some of his other works that sort of have short stories about all these events and how Sauron got where he got to in the previous sort of Dark Lords and things like that. So it's really interesting. There's a whole bunch of stories around that. And then there's like encyclopedias as well and almost guides to the Dwarvish language, the guide to the Elvish language, how the writing works. There's a whole sort of backstory that sort of developed there. I mean, he literally wrote, he made up a language and then wrote poetry and and songs in the other languages as well. So it's really a bit really a bit crazy. I get a bit bored reading that. When I get to the songs, I tend to skip over that. But I mean, that's quite interesting anyway.
I wanted to ask, so I can, you know, I've just read The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, but are there any bits in Lord of the Rings that you think could have been cut out? Any storylines or characters?
Yeah, that's not Tolkien, though. You can't cut out stuff.
Even if it doesn't contribute to the plot.
Things do drag on a bit sometimes, right? So the long march through the marshes and all that, and Frodo getting very sad and Sam getting very sad. It's a trudge, right? But I guess that's the point of stretching that out, because it was essentially, or would have been, a trudge for the character.
So if you get to something like that in a book or a bit that you're not enjoying, do you kind of skim through or skip ahead?
Yeah, I'm a little bit of a speed reader. I'll scan sometimes when I get to the bits that are what I think, particularly on the second read of a book, I would speed read a lot more and I'll skip. So I've read Lord of the Rings 2 or 3 times now, I guess. I just finished reading Hobbit again quite recently and I speed read a lot of it. So,
what do you think of the movie adaptations?
I think they're pretty good. I think they skipped a lot of stuff in them. The whole story of Sting, right? The sword. Out of the movies, for example, how it got there. The whole, they go into the forests early on in the Fellowship of the Ring, and they meet sort of a character in the forest, and they stumble upon the swords there. I can't remember all the details, but in that whole scene is cut out from the movie. He just magically gets Sting, right? Okay. But Sting has a whole story behind it, and some of the books also explain how the swords get where they got to and stuff.
I believe they're remaking Lord of the Rings movies again.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, so maybe they'll include that bit.
They can need to make it 6 movies, not 3, or is it right?
Yeah. Can you read us one of your favorite quotes from Lord of the Rings?
This is one of those quotes from the marshes. I believe they're just going up the cliffs in front of the cave with the spider, and I think they're really looking for leadership and heroes, right? I think that's a scene. They sort of really have a pretty dark patch. And Samwise, who's the gardener, right? He's Frodo's gardener, a very simple guy. He just talks about the stories. And I think this is the one that he tells. It's like in the great stories, Mr. Frodo. And it's quite funny because he keeps calling Mr. Frodo Mr. Frodo throughout the story, and they go through out and back. Anyway, it's like in the great stories, Mr. Frodo, the ones that really mattered. Full of darkness and danger they were. And sometimes you didn't want to know the end, because how could the end be happy? How could the world go back the way it was when so much bad had happened? But in the end, it's only a passing thing, the shadow. Even darkness must pass. A new day will come, and when the sun shines, it'll shine out the clearer. Those were the stories that stayed with you. That meant something, even if you were too small to understand why. But I think Mr. Frodo, I do understand. I know now. Folk in those stories had lots of chances of turning back, only they didn't. They kept going because they were holding on to something, that there is something good in this world, and it's worth fighting for.
Have you used that in your life to keep you going?
I wouldn't say I have a dark lord to fight at any point in time.
Not even actuarial exams.
Yeah, I mean, actuarial exams, I'm not sure. I just kept going, but I don't think that was particularly heroic. More slightly idiotic sometimes, I feel. But no, I think it was, I think it's a good thing to think of, particularly if you think about where we are in the world right now. It seems pretty dark at the stage. And I think just thinking about, you know, we need to fight and push for the good and for the right and for those kind of things. I think that's a valuable lesson, and I think that's basically what the whole book is about, in a sense, is fighting against something that seems insurmountably dark and difficult and dealing with it.
Yeah, and to keep going and know that there's something worth fighting for.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite character, either from Lord of the Rings or anywhere, any of the Middle Earth universe?
My favorite character? I do like Gollum in a way. Is a bit split. Frodo and Samwise are a bit dramatic at times, so I tend to steer away from them. I don't know. Yeah, I would say Aragorn is pretty cool. I don't really I don't really have one, I think. I think maybe some of the women are pretty cool. I think the lady of the horse people, I can't remember what they're called, the horse characters. There's a princess that becomes quite a strong character in there. So that's pretty interesting for such an old book as well.
Mm.
So yeah, that's pretty cool. I don't really think I have a strong favorite. Maybe Gandalf. Maybe Gandalf is a favorite.
Well, who doesn't love Gandalf?
Yeah.
So, Lou, you have recently been appointed onto Asset Council.
Yes.
So what do you see your role in council being, or perhaps what are some of the challenges you see the actuarial profession facing?
Yeah, I mean, when I decided to stand for council, I think there was three or four, and I need to remember now clearly, three or four areas of concern that I sort of said things that are challenges to facing the actuarial profession. And I think for me, it's one is a challenge of relevance, making sure that we're relevant in society broader than just our insurance and pension and short-term insurance and all those kind of topics that we're really dealing with, being broadly more relevant. And I think one of those core concepts is the work that I felt. I mean, I was a member of the COVID Actuary Response Group in the sort of the UK-based mainly COVID Actuary Response Group, but I mean, I was certainly not the main player there. And those guys really did good work in terms of making actuaries relevant to a critical problem at the hand where the actual skills set was very relevant. And I think we need to adopt that kind of thinking, some of those lessons learned from that, and apply it to things like challenges in South Africa. Whatever they may be, may it be education, NHI, all these kind of topics. I think actuaries have a strong voice to influence where society is heading with those things, and we need to make sure we're relevant and communicating that. So I'd like to see a lot more of that. I also feel that I think the way we make sure that we're sticking to our code, I think we need to make sure that we're doing that effectively, and that is running as well as it could be. And I think there's room for improvement there. I think I'd like to see better handling of those kind of issues in terms of making sure we have that actuaries act with integrity and they're following the code, and that our code is also up to scratch. I really do think something we need to pay attention to that and make sure that we have our three laws of robotics, if you will, all written down and understood, and that people are sticking to them, because unfortunately we can't hardwire it into our brains, right? The other areas, I think, is transformation. Now, this is the area that I'm not an expert on, but I do think we need to make sure that our profession strives to be more and more representative of the population of South Africa the more we can. And that starts at the top and also from the bottom up. And really strongly related to that, I think education. Our education is important. And particularly, I think we need to... I feel I'm quite a technical person, and I feel that we need to make sure that our technical quality in education stays good and becomes better, in my view. I'd really like to see strong technical actuaries out there. I think there's sometimes a sort of a fork in the road for some actuaries who become more business-orientated rather than technical, and that's fine, but I think we need to make sure that there's a strong technical base still out there and it doesn't shrink.
So do you have the authority to kind of tackle these challenges that you've identified?
I think many of the council members share a lot of those views. So it's us working together and making sure that we can tackle those issues. And where we disagree, because obviously we all disagree and everybody has their own opinions, we find a way forward such that we can push the society forward and really, really work on that. So I think it's... You know, everybody has a slightly different angle on these things. Some have different angles, some other things that they want to push forward. But I think together we're broadly striving to push the society forward and improve the society and keep it running well.
Yeah, and we're very lucky to have you doing
that.
So the third series, or the third books you've brought along, are Discworld series by Terry Pratchett. And I think you've brought along or two that we can show. Any relevance to the ones that you've chosen to bring, or are they just the ones that you have to hand?
No, I was being interviewed by a lady, so I thought I'd bring equal rights. and then
can
the
never
fifth
go
elephant,
wrong.
Because I think it's a bit of a play on the fifth element, the movie. If you don't recall that. And Terry Pratchett is a bit of the opposite of Tolkien, right?
I've never read a Terry Pratchett book.
You have to read it. If you've read Lord of the Rings, you have to read Terry Pratchett, because there's a It's a tongue in cheek. There's a lot of jokes about Tolkien in Terry Pratchett. I can't remember anyone now, but it's really much the opposite of this dreary fantasy, serious fantasy world that is Lord of the Rings and many other books in fantasy world. This is very tongue in cheek, very funny, but very good as well, and there's a lot of truths, right? Like Samwise in Tolkien, who's this simple character that makes a lot of valid observations. There's a lot of simple characters in Terry Pratchett makes very clever observations.
Like the wise fool, the wise jester.
Well, yeah. The witches are very funny, for example. There's the three witches, and I think that's what – I can't remember exactly what Equal Rights is about. I can't remember the one, but really there's the three witches, and they're obviously female, right? So when they get essentially treated – you know, sidelined by, you know, the princes and the kings and whatnot, they're kind of fighting for their equal rights. But the one witch is, for example, very plain and simple and quite crude, if you will, makes a lot of crude innuendos and jokes. But she has a lot of truthful sayings. And then there's a serious witch, which just, like, doesn't take any, feedback from the official way of doing things and does it her way, and her way is the highway. So that's kind of quite an interesting things like that. So the characters are very wise and interesting. Right? So they say quite clever things.
Yeah. So do you have to start at the beginning, or can you pick up, you know, can I pick up Equal Rights and
you can
and
start
be okay?
Either, I think so. I mean, it'll be, I don't think it's such a story, because he has lots of different characters and stories, right? So there's a story of the young guy who becomes deaf, right? And that's unrelated to the witches, for example. And there's a couple of books on the witches. And then there's the funniest ones, I think, is the ones about the Night Watch as well. It's the Night Watch of the city called Ankh Morpork, which is basically London. If you read between the lines, it's a very dirty and run-down London. And basically, the city that's just sort of this organism of its own that sort of just, there's a Night Watch there which tries to actually avoid crime as much as possible, but every now and then solves a crime, right? So, and the stories around them is quite good. So there's a whole bunch of different sets of characters that play in a couple of stories each. So yeah, so there's a bunch of Night Watch stories. There's the guy of the there's a money one as well. I can't remember what it's called. Somebody gets in charge of the economy, minister of finance type situation for this Ankh Morpork and how he runs the economy. And then there's one about the guy takes over the postal service and how does he run that. So it's quite funny little stories like that. So, but it's all set in the same sort of universe, traveling on the back of four elephants standing on the top of a turtle.
The discord is,
of course, flat, right?
Okay. So where would you suggest someone start?
With Terry Pratchett?
Yeah.
I don't know. There is a suggested reading list which have them in order. I mean, there's so many books. You don't have to read them, but there is a theoretical order. Yeah.
Okay.
I would try and at least read the Witches in order or the Night Watch in order, because that helps build, because the characters do move on over time.
Can you read one of your favorite quotes from?
These are from some of the witches, I think. So you know about having an open mind. The trouble with having an open mind, of course, is that people insist on coming along and trying to put things in it. Right, so I quite like that one. Esk, which is, I think, the main witch, she has not, Esk, of course, has not been trained. And it's well known that a vital ingredient of success is not knowing that what you're attempting can't be done. So really, you know, knowing too much about a topic might actually limit you in terms of trying to challenge convention, if you will, in that sort of area. So yeah, I quite like those. That's a kind of little bits of wisdom from some of these characters in Terry Pratchett.
So on the topic of open-mindedness, you know, I don't know if it was only through your work on COVID, but you know, you're also quite interested in the risk of disinformation and everything that comes with that. How do you keep an open mind but still guard against it being so open that, you know, you can't fight again? You know, what guidelines do you apply?
I don't think it's guidelines, but I think, I mean, if you're talking about something like COVID, it's really, I mean, early on you have lots of information coming in and so something like that. HIV is kind of similar, right? I mean, I wasn't there in the 90s. I wasn't working then. But in 2000, when I started at January in early 2000, I was working on HIV and trying to make sense of HIV from an insurance perspective for January. And it's very similar. You kind of read, you start to get information, you sort of figure out what makes sense and starting to build up a consistent picture of how things connect together. And then using research, right? So now you have a sort of a model in your head, maybe, or roughly about how things are progressing. So for COVID, you get infected, you pass it on, you have a mortality rate, and you know, that's a story. So how does that play out? Now find research to justify assumptions in that sort of model. Is that model broken? Oh no, we don't have full immunity. If we've got COVID once, we might still get it again. So that model needs to adjust, right? So that breaks the model. Things like that. So, and as you build up that worldview, you need to kind of support those assumptions with ever more credible pieces of data. And at this, you know, and where you have information that's breaking a strong view on that, you need to really have good information to break that. So that's kind of how I look at it. I see 20 papers saying, you know, vaccination reduces the risk of of serious illness and death. Mm. And then if somebody says vaccination is killing people, more people than the disease, I would say that doesn't gel. Show me the research. And if I find very good, credible research, then you need to have an open mind to admit that. But for example, for that particular example, I haven't found any credible research that shows the counter to all the tons and tons of research that shows that it has benefits. So that's kind of how I think about it. So you need to, you know, early on, your mind needs to be open, but you need to kind of solidify a few things over time. And then when to shake those solid foundations, you need to put more evidence than shaking things when there's big uncertainty on everything. So that's kind of how I think.
Basically a scientific approach.
Effectively.
So what do you think, what have some of your biggest learnings been about disinformation, from the COVID experience and anything else?
I think the biggest thing that I've learned is that it's very difficult. It is a tremendous drain on resource and energy to fight disinformation because it's so easy and quick to generate disinformation. Mm. It is very difficult to disprove it in any shape or form. It's a lot of work, right? So if you want to say random things, I can say a lot of things in this interview that are wrong. For you to go and prove what I've said is wrong will take you a lot longer than the interview, right? A lot longer. So the disproportionate nature of that, and that's then amplified by social media and videos and things like that where people and presentations as well. I think in presentations, we need to think about being much more careful about how we present things. Because it can often just, you can say a lot of things in a presentation without actually providing any proof of that. And, mm. and I think presentations, videos, interviews and short tweets, those things are very difficult to provide good evidence. So you need to really craft your, if you want to be good about it, I think you need to craft your language very well when you're using those mediums to make sure that you are saying things in a short way, in an efficient way, but also making sure that what you're saying is backed up and having those references ready or available or backed up there. I think that's a really challenge to, you know, that's the problem with disinformation, but in a way it's also a challenge to people who wants to communicate and be relevant, as I said earlier, be relevant in the debate and what's happening, to provide short enough piece of information that's well backed up and properly backed up. In an efficient way. I think that's the challenge of actually being relevant is being able to provide the short bits of information in the right amount of time with properly backed up research.
Well, that's the thing, in the right amount of time. So it's easy to respond quickly when you don't have to back it up.
But I mean, what you need to do is you need to respond quickly and have it backed up, if not right there and then, at least knowing what you're saying and knowing your stuff and having those references at hand.
I've written a little bit about this on your blog, which we haven't mentioned now. So your blog is called Unsupervised. What kind of articles or what kind of research do you publish on there?
Just whatever it's not really work, but maybe a little bit related. So unsupervised, the name comes from the concept of unsupervised learning, right?
Okay.
And I thought this was like a little joke play on the word of unsupervised learning. So we're talking about things that are not necessarily strictly work or maybe sort of related to work. I also talked about some of the actuarial challenges there. For example, compared the code of conducts between the UK and between the IFI and South African society there and things like that. So that's kind of the stuff that I thought was interesting. And other things I talk about there is I try to debunk some disinformation there.
I like the name. I was thinking I should start one called Unregulated with all the regulation we deal with.
Yeah.
Okay, so the fourth and final series of books we're going to talk about today is the Space Odyssey series by Arthur C. Clarke. Yeah. And I looked at his Wikipedia page and hundreds of books that he's published. Yeah. Can you tell me about the ones that you're interested in and when you read them?
I read these a long time ago, so my knowledge is a bit fuzzy, but I did really enjoy a lot of it. You were asking about science, and Arthur C. Clarke was actually I think it was in the 60s or 70s, he figured out that it's likely that we're going to use satellites for communications. So okay. He's quite clever, right? He was quite clever.
When did that happen in real life? After that?
Later, yeah. Okay. They only started, I don't know when they started using geosynchronous, you know, the satellites that don't change position relative to the Earth. Those are used to advance communications, like your satellite TV and stuff like that. It comes from that. So he kind of envisaged that like early on as a science fiction writer. I'm not sure what his background was. Anyway, his stories are really early on, the Space Odyssey, which is a bit esoteric, really. Even the first book is quite weird. If you've watched the movie, it's a very trippy movie as well, the first Space Odyssey one. But it was,
is that Stanley Kubrick?
Kubrick directed it, yeah. But it's very interesting, I think. His books gets a bit more esoteric and philosophical. There's more things around later on. So Space Odyssey is man's first contact with alien life. And really, effectively, during the movie, they figured out, during the three books and well, obviously the movie as well, they figured out that man was actually, it's a what they call a sentinel. So there's a object around Jupiter. They go there. The object sends out a signal, right?
Okay.
And effectively the backstory of this movie is that object was previously on Earth when man pre-man discovered fire, right?
Okay.
And basically they figure out that man was essentially a little bit of an experiment. Some alien beings actually prompted the development and of fire and then everything that came afterwards. And then after that, there was a sort of a marker for once man reached Jupiter, that was a mark to this alien beings or alien consciousness. I don't think they ever show the beings. But they, the marker for this alien consciousness that they actually reached a certain stage of development and then it sends off a signal to this.
Man
is now actually past because they are able to travel to other planets and things like that. So that's the book. Later on, then man develops a lot more. There's this concept of space elevator, Fountains of Paradise is a book where they literally have a satellite and a cable to the ground, and then people go up to space in an elevator, effectively, or fancy cable car, and further books around how man then starts to explore the universe and goes to other worlds, etc. So that's basically.
Okay, can you read us a quote from the Space Odyssey series?
Yeah. I'm not sure if this is Space Odyssey or one of the other books. I can't remember which one it's from. This is I remember the scene, actually. I don't know which book it was, but I remember the scene. This is an engineer who's currently working in space, I believe. It was the actual scene, and he hurts his thumb or whatever he does. He starts swearing, and then the quote is, Afrikaans is one of the world's best languages in which to curse, because this is now one of the this engineer is now one of the million last speakers of Afrikaans in the world. So Afrikaans is one of the world's best languages in which to curse. Even when spoken politely, it can bruise innocent bystanders. So that's quite thought that was quite
amazing. But how did the Afrikaans come into this series?
There happens to be an engineer who used to write Afrikaans. I don't know. This was the only reference. So that just thought it was funny.
Yeah. So as part of your day job, I think you said you are looking at advanced experience analysis and specifically the overlap of actuarial science and advanced analytics. Mm. So What are the latest developments you're looking at in that area?
I think there's a couple of things, and it's not really latest, but it's really just establishing more actual practice around them. And I've worked, for example, with me and Ronald Richmond in 2019, we did a paper covering some of these types of topics. But it's really around how do you model mortality or experience incidence rate, if you will, relative to an existing assumption.
Mm-hmm.
So you can actually leverage existing information by doing this. How do you allow for and then build in an additional factors? And then how do you increase the number of variables that you look at? So we look at age, gender, and smoker status and a few other factors when we do mortality, right? How can we build in more factors then? How can we figure out which of those factors to build into? And particularly, how do we look at interactions? Because many of our actual tables are a mortality curve, a multiplier for a few factors, and that's quite a simple set of assumptions because those things don't interact in a linear fashion, or in this case, a log linear fashion. There are interactions between, because the differential between smoker status and gender is different for different genders, right? You know, there's a different smoker. And we all know this, but how do we model that effectively? And how do we use the information, the limited information we have, in an effective way to get to those relationships? And that's really a lot of the stuff is around that. And applying sort of effectively credibility or cross-validation in this case to ensure that we don't overfit the data and we use what we already have. So that, those kind of techniques, I think, is important. In that paper, we also developed more techniques around delay, IBNR. You mentioned IBNR or something close to IBNR earlier. How do you model claim delays? And we used to do the runoff triangle, but the runoff triangle is a very blunt tool. It doesn't actually take account of the different characteristics of people claiming, right? So somebody who's younger might actually take longer to claim than somebody who's older. This is a relationship we've seen.
Okay.
So age comes into IBNR. How do we bring age into IBNR? Do we make a runoff triangle for each age? That's impossible. You don't have enough data. So how do you then use similar techniques like GLMs to actually translate IBNR into something more useful and more generalizable? And then, you know, there's more research in that sort of space. So I think there's some newish, some of it is already in the short-term side, but I think some of this stuff is relatively new for life in particular.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. Do you think the life insurance industry is ready for that level of complexity in their experience monitoring or experience analysis?
Some of it is not necessarily needed in all cases. But I mean, I'm currently working in Australia where disability, lump sum disability claims, which is really what they call TPD, or we also call it that, but can have an average delay of 2 years to be notified, right?
Oh, wow.
So that's the average.
Oh,
so
gosh,
if you want to look at your most recent experience, you either have to cut out the last 4 years of experience, which is a long time to ignore when you're pricing on group policies, right? You need to somehow get a method for allowing for that runoff and then understand, when is it 3 years and when is it 1 year, right?
Gosh. It's like looking at stars and knowing what the light you're seeing is.
driving while looking in the rearview mirror, right? So you're looking back 2 or 3 years and you need to set the course now, right? So
the last book is a bit of a departure from the previous four, and it's actually, you know, it's a standalone book called Sophie's World by Jostein Gaarde. I did try and research how to pronounce that name. It's really complicated. But we've brought that one along today. Yeah, can you tell us what this one's about?
This is interesting. I don't want to spoil it too much because there's also a bit of a spoiler alert on this one. But it's a book that explains philosophy, which I think is interesting. I'm not big into philosophy, but I think this gave me a nice sort of background on it. And I probably should reread that again because I think I don't remember a lot. So if you want to read a fiction story that gives you a bit of a nonfiction education, it's not a bad one. And basically it tells the story of philosophy. And I think it's the method that starts off as a girl, I think it's a teenage girl, that's receiving letters from a stranger that explains to her some of the concepts of philosophy with examples. And then the book gets recursive. So essentially, as they move to the more difficult philosophical issues, the book becomes recursive.
What does that mean?
I don't want to spoil it, though. So basically, okay. basically the characters in the book discover that they are a tool for somebody else.
Oh, okay.
The characters in the book discover that they are characters in the book.
It's very meta.
Yeah, essentially, like I call it recursive, basically because they start figuring out that somebody's reading the book and they try to communicate to the person reading the book so that they can get sort of out of the book effectively. So okay. That's, I think that all relates to philosophical concepts, which I can't remember, to be honest, but yeah.
So how did this book come into your life?
I don't know. I think I read it in university. Probably somebody recommended
it. It was a good few years for you, for your reading. Very formative. Yeah. Would you like to read us a quote from this book?
Oh, yeah, it's really about questions. So kind of things around that. Wisest is she who knows she does not know. So really understanding what you don't know, basically, it's that sort of concept. And it's not a silly question if you can't answer it, right? And then the most subversive people are those who ask questions. So those are some of the quotes that I sort of...
It's almost the opposite of the Dunning-Kruger effect, right?
Yeah. If you don't ask questions, you probably don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and if you don't know that you don't know, then you think you know more than you do. I know... It
kind of relates to disinformation as well, right?
Yeah, it's all linked. And maybe it also relates to the concept of fairness, which I'm guessing you're working on in terms of underwriting and things, but is there also some kind of ethical, philosophical angle to
I didn't think about to this like concept? That. Yeah, I mean, I haven't worked on this a lot, and I figured out it's actually quite difficult to work on this, to think about fairness, and I can maybe just explain some of the concepts here. The main thing is what we call fairness is not a simple concept, right? What you and I call fair, somebody else might not call fair, right? Mm. Because there's different definition of fair. So one of my colleagues wrote her honors, I think, thesis or something around this, and she kind of summarized it, and she reminded me of this work a year or two ago when I just wanted to talk about fairness, and particularly this AI technology, which is coming out, which might be quite difficult to think about fairness, right? So how fair is if we made one of these large AI bots decide on pricing or underwriting decisions, how fair are they going to be? How do we know that they're being fair? So then she reminded me of this, and I looked at that, and she sort of summarized that to me, and she said there's different kinds of fairness, right? So in a world where some concept of fairness is that everybody should be treated equal, right? It's almost like a medical scheme. When you're a member of a medical scheme, there's not much price differentiation. Mm. It's everybody's treated the same. There's no underwriting. It's compulsory as well. Obviously, those things all go together, right? And then in another world, the libertarian world, the insurance company or whoever's making the price can do anything, right? They're not restricted anyway. So those are the two extremes, right? So then you go into the middle, and there's some concept of, I think it's called luck egalitarianism, which means you are not allowed to discriminate against people who are where they are because of luck, right? So imagine a person who is suffers from Huntington, it's a genetic disease. So okay. It's purely random or it's bad luck, right? So they didn't make a choice about that, right? So we're not allowed to underwrite on genetics necessarily in that world where that's the concept of fairness. The same applies actually to gender. Actually, in that world, you shouldn't be differentiated on your gender because you can't choose your gender. But if you don't exercise and you or you jump off buildings with parachutes or without parachutes, more risky. We can underwrite that and we can price you, we can give you high risk because that's within your control. That sounds very interesting and good. But if you think about something like cholesterol, or which is partly lifestyle, partly genetics, how do you control for that? Right? There's a lot of things that are not as simple as blood, you know, either one or the other. So that becomes complicated. So those are the kind of things that you can think about. Now, and then Ronald Richmond, which I mentioned earlier, also wrote a paper on pricing now in this world, in this EU world where gender is now removed, right? Because it's because they are focusing on this luck thing.
Right.
They're focusing on that quite a bit. So they said you can't price on gender. Now, if you look at life insurance, we price on smoker status, right? So if you price on smoker status, you just remove from your experience studies gender and you just look at smoking mortality and non-smoking mortality, that sounds like fair, but it's actually not, right? Because you're indirectly discriminating on gender because men tend to smoke more. So your smoker rates actually reflect more male rates and your non-smoker rates reflect more female rates. So actually there's a problem there. So that all that sort of bits and pieces that I'm talking about really tells me that fairness is not something that's a simple concept to think. Because even in the same market, different concepts of fairness applies in different situations. In medical aids, fairness is egalitarian. It's almost egalitarian. In individual life insurance, it's much more rating factors we can allow for there, right? And then in other areas, we limit it in different ways, right? In the UK, for example, postcodes are not often used in life insurance pricing. But it is used in annuities pricing because it uses a different concept of fairness there. You can discriminate if it is to the benefit of those who are previously disadvantaged. So in longevity pricing, postcodes gives an advantage to lower income earners because they get better annuities, right? So that's another concept of fairness that I didn't even cover, right? So those situations come up and it makes it very difficult. And it also makes me realize that even for something as simple as just never mind all these advanced analytical models we're dealing with, even just based on gender and smoker status or income and education in South Africa, there's the potential to be actually discriminating accidentally. And so even our simple pricing methods without any fancy analytics or large language models or AIs or anything like that already has potential issues depending on how you see fairness. And there's many ways to see fairness. So basically what my lesson is from this, it's complicated.
Yeah. And, you know, we have, I guess, limited regulation and legislation, but then beyond that, you know, which ethical philosophical frameworks do you choose to,
yeah,
to help?
I don't think it's a choice that actuaries can make. I think it's a society choice.
Good. So we've spoken through all the books. Just to recap, we spoke about The Foundation Universe by Isaac Asimov, The Middle Earth Universe or series by J.R.R. Tolkien, Discworld series by Terry Pratchett, The Space Odyssey series by Arthur C. Clarke, and Sophie's World by Jostein Gaarder. If I had to put you on a desert island and you could only bring one of these books and one of these series with you, which one would it be?
I think if I'm all alone, I'm not going to take any of the serious things. I think Terry Pratchett.
And hopefully, you know, there's so many of them that, you know, you'll never run out. And before I let you go, I'm going to ask you some quick fire questions about your reading as well. Okay. So Kindle or physical books?
Both.
And opinion on audiobooks, is it cheating?
It's too slow. Audiobooks is too slow.
Do you stop reading books if you're not enjoying them?
Yes.
that is the common wisdom. Do you use the Goodreads app?
Used it. I haven't used it recently. Yeah.
Do you know how many books you read last year? Or fun?
Not a lot.
Do you judge
10 or 20?
Do you judge a book by its cover?
No, not really. I need to get a good recommendation. The cover doesn't really influence me that much.
Who do you get your recommendations from?
Just conversations randomly, reading something about a book. Yeah.
If you wrote a fictional book, what would the subject or the genre be?
Probably sci-fi. The sci-fi, it would probably be something similar to what Asimov did. I like the statistics. Sorry, just going back to the questions. The statistical, there's something there that's not really, that's the only book I've ever, any sci-fi book that has a bit of actuarial type statistics in there. So I think something of that line might be interesting. That will be very boring for everybody else.
That's okay. Yeah. Okay, and what are you currently reading?
I just finished The Hobbit, actually. I was on a flight and I opened my tablet and I saw, I started it at some point a couple of months ago. I must have started The Hobbit, so I just continued it. And you know, on the flight up, I read half, and on the flight back, I read the other half kind of thing. Well, and a bit at night, so, you know.
So it's like a comfort read.
Yeah, yeah. It was a quick one.
Okay. Well, Thank you so much, Louis, for joining me today.
Thank you. If
people do want to find out more about your work or what you're busy with, where can they get hold of you?
I'm on Genry's website with a few articles there. I'm on social media, but I tend to be quite quiet now that COVID is gone. To keep a lowish profile. And I've written a few things on my website.
Thank you so much. It's been a privilege.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for the opportunity.